We are talking today with Peretz Kidron, who has compiled and edited the book Refusnik, Israel Soldiers of Conscience. Peretz, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Start out and tell us, how is it that you came to put this book together?
Well, first and foremost, because I was refusing myself. I'm no longer I'm well past military age, but in the 70s, when the issue of the occupation became painful, and I was still doing my regular 1 month a year reserve service, I found myself, like others of my friends, in this strange situation of spending 11 months in the year campaigning against the occupation, and then being called up in the 12th month, put on uniform, and there I was maintaining, supporting, and enforcing that occupation, to which I was totally opposed. It went against everything I believed in. So it was an enormous moral and personal dilemma for me and people like me who were involved from the beginning in the anti-occupation movement. And the result was the beginnings of refusals. But at that time, it was unorganized. It was a private, personal protest by individuals who simply couldn't abide with the idea of being occupiers, being conquerors. Hebrew, I should say, is much more brutally frank. There's no distinction between occupation and conquest. It's conquest. It's also the term that's used for crushing olives, kibbush. That's a very hard term. Occupation in English is rather bland. And the reality is very brutal. It's very harsh. You have a whole population which has no rights, which is entirely subject to your whims and fantasies, in actual fact, as an occupier. You hold the gun and you give the orders and they obey. It's as simple as that. It's a series of smaller or larger tyrannies where you have absolute control. And that was a position that I found absolutely intolerable. And finally, I wasn't the first. There were others who preceded me, and I agonized over it for a couple of years because it was not an easy step to take then or now. It's an extremely difficult step. But after agonizing over it for a couple of years, finally various things happened. And next time I reported for duty, I said, fine, I'll do any. I've been called up. I'll give a month's service, but nothing to do with the occupation. So that was the way I got to be a refusnik. And then the refusniks a few years later got together and were organized as a refusnik movement. That happened in June 1982 at the time of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And ever since then, there's been an organized refusnik movement with which I've been involved. And as such, these declarations that refusniks delivered in court or in declarations to the defense ministry or letters to the prime minister, where they explained that they were going to break the law, they knew that they were going to break the law and would be punished for that, and explained why they were going to do it. And in that explanation, it was a ringing denunciation of the occupation and all its works. So I collected these things together as part of my work in the refusnik movement, and one day I woke up and I had a book. It just needed a preface, an introduction, some background material, and there it was, ready to go. And it's now been published in 5 languages. It just recently came out in Israel as well, in Hebrew. And I think that people find it of great interest. I can praise it because I didn't write most of it.
So when you started, there was no real structure to any of this, yet had you heard of others who were refusing at the time?
Oh, yeah. But I was involved in the anti-occupation movement. So we were discussing this. This was an entirely new situation. At that time, to us, reserve service was just part of the natural order of things. You ate matzahs at Passover, and you did a month's reserve service. That was automatic. That was routine. Nobody gave it a second thought until suddenly you found that the reserve service was not just this kind of annual summer camp where you played around with jeeps and guns and things, and instead you were a policeman lording it over a captive civilian population who obviously didn't want you there. And that was a whole new game. And we talked among ourselves, what do we do with this? And people said, well, we can't not serve in the army. Okay, that was one no-no. We can't carry on doing this work, which is enforcing the occupation. So between those two impossibles, we worked out something that in hindsight was a very powerful weapon, which we call selective refusal, which is the concept of, if you like, you know, you want to put it in highfalutin terms, it's nonviolent civil disobedience after the manner of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, only applied inside the army. You go along, you're a soldier, you put on a uniform, you obey orders, you do everything except certain things to which you object. And if you refuse to do them, if your refusal results in you going to prison, well, that's part of the risk. That's part of the risk of taking a principled stand. And that has become a very powerful weapon in the Israeli peace movement, in the opposition to the occupation.
Can you give us a sense of how it has changed, if at all, over from when you began to what we see current day, the current day refusenik movement?
Well, we're a little more practiced in the solidarity actions. You know, when a refusenik goes to prison, it's the military prison is in northern Israel, and it happens to be at the foot of the Carmel Mountains, you know, the biblical Carmel Mountains where the prophet Elijah slaughtered the priests of Baal. And just a couple of miles away from there, there's a Crusader castle. So it's very historical. And more recently, it's just by where the British used to imprison illegal Jewish immigrants who came into Palestine in the 1940s. So there's plenty of history in the immediate vicinity. And this prison is at the bottom of the Carmel. And we simply climb the mountain until we're high enough to be visible over the prison walls. And there we hoist our banners and slogans, and we set up a loudspeaker system, and we broadcast our support, music, greetings from family and friends. And it's an enormous moral boost for the refusenik who's in prison. And it's also a very clear message to the hundreds of other prisoners in there. This guy is not on his own. He has backing. There's a community out there. That's very important when you're a small community of protesters. We've grown. We have a much larger community now than we were. But there have been times when we've been up there with 10 or 20 people. Now hundreds of people join us in this vigil that we call it the Vigil on the Hill. We even held a Freedom Seder there at Passover a year ago when the number of refuseniks passed the number of 1,000. And we called it the Seder of 1,000 refuseniks. And we had a rabbi up there, a rabbi refusenik, and he conducted the Seder with a full Orthodox Seder with all the blessings and all the ritual and the whole thing. And it was held as a Freedom Seder overlooking the prison. So we're much better at doing these things. And then there's a lot of new territory that we've entered upon, and the book is an attempt to pursue that, and that is actively to educate young people, youngsters about to join the army, or young people of military age, to educate them to the concept of being a responsible soldier. As a soldier, when you put on uniform, you're still a citizen. You're still responsible politically, morally, in every sense. You're responsible for the things you do. And the most horrible thing that came out of the 20th century were these soldiers who faced trial, and their only defense was, I was a soldier, I was just obeying orders. That's a terrifying thought, because that is reducing the human being to a robot, to a killing machine, with no will of his own, no convictions, no morals, no conscience. And that is a concept that we actively combat. We try to teach people that whatever you do, whatever the order, it's ultimately up to you. And you have to face yourself. You have to look at yourself in the mirror tomorrow morning, and you have to ask yourself. One of the slogans we use is, we put it simply and crudely, decent people don't shoot at children. We put it, you know, really straightforward. And then that's dropping it into the laps of these young people. And then when they go into the army and they put on the uniform, they're given these various orders, they have to wrestle with their own conscience. But we try to stir that conscience and make them think about the issues. So this is a new departure for the refusal movement. And one of the products, or at least partially a product of that, is a wonderful new movement of young refusenik, young high school kids, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, wonderful kids. I'm full of admiration for them. And they got together, 10 of them got together, wrote a letter to Ariel Sharon saying that they would refuse to take part in the repression of the Palestinian people. By the time the letter was published, they had 62 signatures. Today they have over 500. When I talk about these figures, remember we're talking about a small country. If you want an American equivalent, multiply by about 45, 50. All right? Imagine 25,000 American high school kids write a letter of that nature. It would have an enormous moral and political impact on. And particularly, it's not just numbers. These are the brightest and the best. These kids are absolutely amazing. And we saw that subsequently when the first of these began to be called into induction centers and they refused to put on uniform. And five of them were recently court-martialed. And the court-martial, well, the sentence, the verdict was obvious. This was a military tribunal. It wasn't going to let them off. But these kids stood up and they put up such a fight. One after the other. They stood up and they gave 2, 3, 4 hour presentations in which they presented their view of the occupation, things that they had seen and witnessed and experienced, and their friends, and they spoke of their Palestinian friends. And it was one of the most damning indictments of the whole occupation setup that you can ever imagine. It was very impressive. And I repeat, 18, 19-year-old kids standing up against practiced lawyers, and they kicked the daylights out of them. It was amazing. Didn't help them. They got a year in prison on top of over a year that they'd already served, and we don't know what's going to happen to them. We're trying to mount a campaign to get them amnesty because we're very much worried that they will be hauled out of prison and again ordered to join the army and again refuse and will again face a military tribunal. So this could be multiple jeopardy, which by a legal loophole, this is possible. But by any concept of natural justice, it is just the most abhorrent thing. These kids have already been tried half a dozen times and more, and they may possibly face trial again. So one of them, our major actions this year will be to try and raise international support for amnesty for these young people, because it really would be gross injustice if they're sentenced again.
So in Israel, does the military have access into the schools like it does here in the States? And as far as your movement and the peace movement, do they also get access to the schools?
The answer to the second is emphatic no. Though it's not just the military per se. The whole culture, the whole society, and certainly the educational system is pervaded with this concept that the army is sacrosanct, the military service is important, you are serving your people, you're protecting your family. So kids get this from the kindergarten upwards. It's only recently that kindergarten stopped teaching children about this mythological hero. I mean, he was a true character, but his words were mythological. Josef Trumpeldor, who was killed in the early 20s in a clash with Palestinians, and he was reported to have said, "It is good to die for your country." And this was taught to kindergarten children until recently, until people said, "Hey, what the hell are we teaching our kids?" So it's not just that the military has access. The school itself, the school system itself, sanctifies the military service and so on. And I just laughed because this book on the refuseniks was reviewed in an Israeli paper, in one of the best Israeli papers, and they did a glowing review to my utter amazement. And the review ends with a recommendation to the Israeli Ministry of Education that youngsters who graduate from high schools, instead of all sorts of meaningless presents, should get a copy of this book to make them think. I would say that that is probably one of the most unlikely predictions you'll ever hear, because there is no way that the school system will open up to the idea of refusal. It's very definitely biased in favor of the military and the flag waving and all this. So we definitely don't get a fair chance or an equal chance. But we're out there outside the school. We hand out leaflets to the kids. We invite them into seminars and we discuss these issues. It's in no way compares to the brainwashing they get from the school system. But the idea is to get a few of them thinking, here is the problem. Here is a guy who spent 3 years in the occupied territories. Listen to his story. Here is a video of what happens at the checkpost. What do you think of that? And throwing it back into the laps of these youngsters so that when they are called up, they are conscientious, thinking soldiers. And that's really what we're aiming to get, a soldier who thinks, who takes responsibility.
Can you tell us a bit about some of the specific stories? You mentioned that you get some of these actual soldiers to speak to the kids. What ones stand out in your mind?
Well, the fact is that the stories are very often not dramatic. The stories of what happens in the occupied territories is not dramatic. There's a concept in Israeli military law, the black flag, which is taken to denote an order that is so obviously illegal that a soldier is required, under Israeli military law, he is required to disobey. And we've expanded that notion to cover the whole of the occupation, because we say that a regime in which an entire population is stripped of its rights, the most basic elementary human rights, the right to go to school or to go to the pharmacy or to go to a dispensary or to plant a fruit tree in the backyard, to build a house for the children, where all this is denied, that is a basically illegal regime, because it goes against the most basic human rights enshrined in any international or national law constitution. And so we say that this black flag doesn't relate to an individual act of illegality, of brutality towards an individual Palestinian, but the whole occupation regime is a black flag. And that's why people refuse to take any part in it whatsoever. Under that huge black flag that covers the entire regime, that covers the daily conditions of life for 3.5 million Palestinians, there are thousands, tens of thousands of smaller black flags of minor acts of humiliation and bullying. And a lot of this stuff is just undramatic. It sounds like nothing at all. But recently we saw a movie on Israeli television. It was shown on Israeli television. Note this, the Israeli television, in this sense, Israeli media are much more open to these issues than the, for instance, the American media. So this movie showed, was just taken a couple of checkposts, and there was nothing very dramatic there, except I remember one incident that I can't forget. There are these two soldiers, youngsters, nice kids, obviously, but a bit miserable, standing there in the rain, and they have to check the identity cards. And along comes a Palestinian woman holding a baby in her arms and two little children hanging onto her skirts from behind. And she's on the way to take the baby to a dispensary. And the soldier looks at her papers and looks at the kid and looks at the baby. And the soldier says, okay, you can go through with the baby, but you can't take the children. So the mother then has to turn around and drive, yelling and cursing and beating these two little children, driving them away, forcing them to go back home because she's got to go through with a baby. And that terrible inhumanity. And there was no reason for it. There was no cause. She was no terrorist. The baby certainly wasn't. This three-year-old kid who was crying his eyes out obviously wasn't a terrorist. It was just an act of one of the small black flags that exist, that are created naturally in an occupation environment. So these are the stories, these are the incidents that we tell people, that we tell these youngsters, and we ask them, what would you do in a situation like that? What are the rights and wrongs of it? And raise the elements of conscience. What would you do if you were that woman? And render that awareness. So there are thousands and thousands of these incidents, and as I say, the vast majority are not dramatic. It's just the driver coming up to a checkpost and the soldier is in a bad mood, and the soldier leans over and hauls the ignition keys out and puts it in his pocket and says, come back next week and I'll give you your car back. So for no reason at all. I mean, that is part of it. It's not just punishment for a specific act. He's at liberty to do that. If he's asked, he'll come up with some kind of reason why the national security of the state of Israel would be jeopardized if this guy continued driving his taxi around over the next week. But nobody asks for an explanation. He does what he wants.
That movie actually just showed recently at the Seattle International Film Festival. I saw it as well in the States. It's called Checkpoint.
That's right. Machsom is the Hebrew word. Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, very moving movie. Talk about then that on the one hand you have it's legal or illegal to do these black flag operations, and yet the military, within the military, they're also the ones that are in charge of the court-martials. So on the one hand, it seems that you're dealing with just the concept of legalities, and yet these people are who refuse to serve in these situations are serving prison time. Is that correct?
Yes. Recently, a soldier who shot a 95-year-old woman was sentenced to 6 months imprisonment. And these youngsters who acted on their convictions and conscience were given a year's imprisonment. I'm very, very disappointed in the Israeli judicial system, and particularly the army's judicial system. Look, in this intifada, something close to 3,000 Palestinians have been killed. And by the army's own account, something like 600 or 700 were armed militants. That means that over 2,000 unarmed civilians, including hundreds of children, have been killed. I'm not talking about the ones that were injured and maimed. There have been practically no investigations. Nobody has gone into the whys and wherefore. Were all these shootings justified? Was there not one single trigger-happy soldier that just fired off a gun and killed a kid sitting on the terrace of his home or on the way to school or from school or mothers or people certainly without the faintest shadow of a doubt had nothing whatsoever to do with any acts of violence, did not endanger the Israeli army, did not do anything illegal, and these persons were killed, and that doesn't even warrant a criminal investigation. And yet, when youngsters stand up for their convictions, their conscience, and their principles, the full weight of the Israeli military prosecutor's office comes down on them, and they're driven from prison sentence to prison sentence for more than a year, and every kind of coercion is exercised on them, and finally they're court-martialed and denounced as ideological criminals. I mean, the disproportion here is just glaring.
And do you notice a dramatic difference in the way that these situations are viewed between the government and, you were saying, is the media in Israel seems to be far more even-handed?
I didn't say even-handed. The media everywhere. Media is a biased. I mean, it's built in. Whoever owns it, whoever runs it, has a bias. I don't believe in objective reporting. I believe that you give a chance to both sides to present their subjective biased point of view. That's the best you can do. For one person to try to straddle these enormous differences, it's superhuman. But you can be more open. You can say there's certain things which it's okay to say. I may disagree with them totally. I'll let the guy say it, and then I'll let 10 people answer him, and I'll drown out his voice. But he at least will have the chance to put his point of view. And in that sense, I think that the Israeli media are more open. They're biased towards the government, biased towards the army, but every now and then we get a chance to say half a word or get in a quarter of a sentence. And from what I've seen of the American media, in that sense, things are freer on our side.
Have things gotten tougher for the refusal movement since Ariel Sharon came into power?
Well, Ariel Sharon coming into power was part of a whole wave. It was a wave of disillusionment. There was a huge upsurge of peace optimism in the early 90s around the Oslo Accords, around Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. And there was a time of great hope, which reflected in all kinds of things. We had the largest growth rate. Our economy was growing like crazy. I mean, our growth rate was rivaling China's. So we were really doing very, very well. And there was a mood of optimism in the country. And just 5 years ago, Ehud Barak was elected prime minister on an outspoken peace platform, and he got over 60% of the vote. So that was a kind of climate that we certainly enjoyed and appreciated. The fact is that, unfortunately, Barak disappointed those hopes, and his so-called peace policy, 90% of it wasn't, of his pledges weren't carried out, and he didn't achieve peace with Syria, and he didn't seriously pursue peace with the Palestinians, and the peace offer that he made them was offensive and a humiliation, not a real genuine offer. But because of all these events, there has been a wave of disillusionment. People believe the Barak story. The Barak says, you know, we made this wonderful, generous offer and the Palestinians turned it down and they turned to violence. And it's not true, but a majority of Israelis believe it. And believing it, therefore, they turn away from the peace candidates and they gave Sharon this crushing endorsement. Sharon is elected prime minister with the same kind of majority that Barak enjoyed. That means that 20-30% of the Israeli electorate shifted from voting for peace to voting for Sharon. And that, in part, this can be blamed on Barak. In part, it also has to be blamed on the Palestinians. First of all, the Palestinian leadership, which fell down completely in explaining its point of view and explaining what was wrong with the peace offer and explaining its side of the dispute. They just don't try to get through to Israeli public opinion. That's one of the major sins of the Palestinian leadership. They're very, very poor at this. Though they have thousands of young people who are graduates of Israeli prisons and speak excellent, fluent modern Hebrew, and they could really get through, and they know Israelis, and yet nevertheless their propaganda efforts are pathetic. They just don't know how to present their point of view. So Israelis are brainwashed to one point of view, that of the Israeli government. And what reinforces this are the attacks by the Palestinian dissident militant groups on the indiscriminate attacks on Israeli civilians, on persons who have nothing to do with the occupation regime, who are not involved with the military, old people, young children, mothers, bus bombings, an attack on a Passover Seder where the average age of those taking part was 80. And that aroused such a wave of revulsion among Israelis and anger that we have a government and an army which are more or less free to do anything they like. And that is why we have these scenes of wanton destruction in the Rafah refugee camps and the daily killings of Palestinians. And it's condoned, it's largely condoned by Israeli public opinion. So I'm speaking at length about this climate of opinion because this is where we function. This is where we have to try to educate people. Look, whatever happens, the Palestinians are our neighbors. Sooner or later, we're going to have to make a deal with them. Sooner or later, that deal will mean that the Palestinians will demand and deserve to get the same rights that we have. We have a right to a state and independence and security, and they are going to demand the same. We have the right to build a viable economy that can maintain our people at a decent standard of living. They're going to demand the same. So whatever deal is worked out, we'll have to make sure that these conditions exist, and we're going to have to grant them. The question is, are we going to kill and allow our people to be killed? How many hundreds more have to be killed before we get to that position? Because everybody knows that sooner or later we're going to have to deal, and those more or less are the terms. The question is whether we do it before the bloodshed or after the bloodshed. You know, going back into Israeli history, the Egyptians made a land for peace deal in 1971. It was turned down by the Israeli government. After the 1973 war and after we buried 3,000 of our soldiers, that deal suddenly became feasible. We could have had it earlier and cheaper. We paid a bitter price and then it became feasible. I would be very, very sorry if we have to go through the same process vis-a-vis the Palestinians.
What role do you see the United States playing in this movement with bringing peace in the Palestine-Israel
The United States is heavily involved. The United States bankrolls Israel, provides military, political, diplomatic backing. To most Israelis, that American support is enormously important. It's I could call it a security blanket, but it's much more than a security blanket. It's not just the actual physical aid that's provided. It's a reassurance. It's a sense that there's somebody out there who is with us, who's on our side. And that is terribly important to Israelis. And because it's so terribly important, that imposes a terribly heavy burden of responsibility upon the United States. It's like somebody who has enormous influence over an individual who has some terrible, terrible problem. Not employing that influence would be criminal, because if you employ that influence, you might be able to save that person or prevent some terrible development. And that is the state of affairs. And there have been times in the past when United States influence has been employed in a manner that seemed at momentarily to be exerting pressure upon Israel, but ultimately was very much to Israel's benefit. For instance, in 1974, there were negotiations between Israel and Egypt over disengagement, to pull the armies apart, to stop the killings. And the Israeli side dug in its heels because it was afraid that a certain withdrawal would endanger strategic positions. And the then Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, exerted heavy pressure. No, it wasn't even heavy. Just exerted pressure on Israel. And that, as a result of that pressure, Israel gave way and the disengagement went ahead. And as a result of that, Israeli soldiers were saved, weren't killed. And that ultimately paved the way for a peace agreement with Egypt, where again American influence and pressure were exerted upon Israel, ultimately to Israel's own benefit. There was enormous resentment. Why? How come the Americans are twisting arm? They twisted arm, and it was very good, because, you know, ever since the Americans twisted arm, for 30 years, Israelis haven't killed Egyptians and Egyptians haven't killed Israelis. And I'd say thank you very much to the United States, and thank you very much to then President Jimmy Carter, who, when he saw that Begin was digging in his heels and refusing to make the concessions that were necessary for peace, he said those blessed words, "In that case, Mr. Prime Minister, you're on your own." And that was all that needed to be said for Begin to understand that he was left on his own without U.S. support, and he made the concession, and those concessions brought about the peace. So I see nothing vile or horrifying or terrifying in the United States exerting this enormous influence that it has to Israel's benefit. If it's exerting that pressure to bringing about some kind of peace, some kind of understanding with our neighbors, that can only be to Israel's benefit.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Peretz Kidron, who has compiled and edited the book Refusnik, Israel Soldiers of Conscience. So do you see a role here for, regardless of what the U.S. government does, do you see a role here for U.S. citizens in this situation?
Very much so. And as you mentioned, you were kind enough to mention the book. I'll go back to it. One of the purposes of publishing that book in English is to bring to the attention and knowledge of the American public the fact that there are Israelis, good patriotic Israelis, soldiers, officers, individuals who have rendered distinguished service in the army. You don't get to be a captain or a major in the Israeli army in one of the combat units by lying around and getting a suntan. You have to work hard to get that. And these people, after long service dedicated to the security of Israel, are convinced that the security of Israel is best served by ending the occupation, ending the armed conflict with the Palestinians, and trying to achieve a feasible and dignified political settlement with the Palestinian leadership. And I think it's important for the American media and the American public to hear that other voice, to know that Israel is not Sharon. Sharon is our prime minister. He was elected by a majority. authority. There's no question about his legitimacy, and I don't argue about that. But there is an Israeli opposition which says there is another way, there is an alternative, that we can save all this bloodshed and devastation. Because I should mention, this is not altruism. This is not out of an overwhelming concern for the welfare of the Palestinian people. It's also overwhelming responsibility for the future of the state of Israel. In this situation, in this conflict with the Palestinians, Israel suffers terribly. We have hundreds of thousands of unemployed. We have tens of thousands of businesses closing down. We have our brightest and best young people getting up and leaving the country because they see no future. We have, in the present situation, our economy is suffering so badly that of every three Israeli children, one grows up in a household that subsists below the poverty line. One in three children. And this, against the Jewish tradition, that children are sacrosanct and they have to be protected and coddled. And the occupation is taking such a terrible toll at many different levels, at the moral level. These youngsters who go into the occupied territories and they come from nice homes and they've been taught to behave in a civilized manner, and for 3 years they behave the way you saw in that movie. They can't come back unscathed. They don't come back the same kind of kids. And we do have a tremendous upsurge of criminality and violence and domestic violence as well, and very many cases of women being killed by their spouses. And sometimes the killing is carried out with the army-issue rifle that the husband or the male partner has received as part of their reserve service. So the cost to Israel is enormous. And therefore, when these people say, I will go to prison rather than serve the occupation regime, it's as much out of concern for himself and his family and his society and his country as it is out of concern for the Palestinians. It's not a win-lose situation. It's a lose-lose situation at the moment, and we are desperately concerned to make it into a win-win situation in which both sides gain, in which the Palestinians gain the dignity and independence they deserve, and in which Israel also gains the ability to advance and prosper in the way that we were in the early 90s. That was such a shining example of what peace can bring us.
Do you see the refusal movement in Israel as being an independent movement, or do you see it tied into a greater worldwide movement?
I'm very proud to say that we lead a worldwide movement. There have been refuseniks in every army in the 20th century. There have been soldiers, including even soldiers of the German army, who were shot for refusing to take part in things that they considered unacceptable. So every army in the 20th century, everyone knows that there were refuseniks in the American army in the Vietnam period. I recently met some French soldiers, former soldiers who'd spent time in prison for refusing to take part in the colonial war in Algeria. There were Russian soldiers who deserted or defected or refused to fight in Afghanistan. So each of these major conflicts has produced protests from within the army. The innovation that we have in Israel is that we've organized this and that we campaign. This is not, it began as a protest of individuals, as it did in other arms. We've built this into an organized group. There are now 1,300 individuals of military age, soldiers, reservists, officers, youngsters about facing induction, who have signed a clear commitment saying they will not take part in the occupation and in the repression of the Palestinian people. Again, multiply the figures. We're talking about a small country. We are 1,300. That would be the equivalent in the United States of something well over 50,000. I think that would be a significant number. And the more significant number is the invisible one, the hidden one that we don't know. Because every refusenik has 3, 5, 10 friends who are on the verge of refusal, who are considering refusal. And to use a term that the military loves to use, this is deterrence. The army knows how many refuseniks there are at this moment. The army has no idea how many refuseniks are lurking just around the corner, have made up their minds by 90%, but they need that last, that final push, that final straw that will break through and say, they too will say, Yesh Gvul, which is Hebrew for, there's a limit, so far and no further. And that is the power of the refusenik movement, because on top of those who are already there, the army never knows when a unit can become unreliable. When formerly there was one soldier, an officer, all of a sudden there are 15. There were cases in the Lebanon War, there was a very famous case when a paratroop brigade, an entire brigade, was not mobilized because the army had got wind that there were many refuseniks there, and they decided that rather than face the humiliation of dozens of soldiers declaring refusal, they would be better off not mobilizing that brigade. So it has become a very powerful element. Now, I believe that this is something that shouldn't be uniquely Israeli. I'm very worried about the power, the devastation of a modern army, the firepower, the power of destruction that a relatively small unit can employ in this day and age with modern military technology. And therefore, I think it's enormously important that soldiers are educated to their responsibility in the way that we do with Israeli soldiers. They have to know what they're doing. These aren't toys that they're playing with. These are murder weapons. And they have to think what it is they're doing and why they're doing it. And they have to consider the orders. And they have to not be robots, not cogs in the wheel. They have to consider what their convictions tell them, not just what the officer tells them to do. And if we can get that kind of education, we won't get it out of the army. The army wants obedient soldiers, and I can understand that. It would be pretty absurd to expect the army to teach soldiers, hey, take a good look at those orders, they may be illegal. I mean, formally the army may go through the motions of teaching that particular element of the military code, but they don't really want the soldiers to take it too seriously, because then they'd have trouble. Okay, we said it, but now from this moment on, you better damn well obey every order you get, because otherwise you're in bad trouble. That's the message that goes across. So what is needed is an organization, a group, independent of the army, independent of the military hierarchy, that grabs the soldiers like we do, and we say, soldier, where are you going? We hand out these leaflets at transport centers where soldiers are headed back to the occupied territory, and the leaflet says, soldier, where are you going? And the question is not the actual destination. Where are you going? What are you doing? What is the point of the exercise? Soldier, think. Soldier, think it over. Do you really think it's worth doing what you're doing to protect a bunch of fanatical settlers who could bring ruin upon the state of Israel? So we throw all these questions at them. And those questions should be thrown at every soldier in every army in the world. We have a parallel, a sister organization in Greece called Dictis Spartacus, named after Spartacus, the legendary rebel. And they send out the same message to Greek soldiers. And they organize Greek soldiers to resist service outside Greece. And they tell the Greek soldiers, defend your country, fine. Defend its borders, fine. But don't cross the borders. Don't go into Macedonia. Don't go into Kosovo. Don't go on various missions outside Greece, because that's not legitimate. They do the same thing that we do. We draw the line between legitimate service and non-legitimate service. And I'd be very happy to see similar organizations wherever there's an army. Wherever orders are given, soldiers have to be told, you know, the order is from flesh and blood. It's not from divine providence. And flesh and blood can err, flesh and blood can sin, flesh and blood can issue orders that must be disobeyed. Not that can be ignored. Must. It is your duty, to your moral duty, to disobey, to flout that order. And that's a message that every soldier needs to hear.
Do you think the significance of the refusal movement in Israel is even greater because of the current climate there, as well as in the U.S.? There's this new, I don't know if it's new, but it's been labeled the new war on terror. And the citizens of both countries, certainly more in Israel, have this heightened sense of that things are even worse than they've been.
I think in any war situation this applies. They're always at war, and always at war the enemy is dehumanized. War, because of the death and destruction, war legitimizes all kinds of things which under any other circumstance would be intolerable. And therefore it's desperately important to impose limits. That's the meaning of Yesh Gvul, the limit of on duty, the limit on obedience, the limit, the physical, geographical limit of the places where you can serve and where you can't. So the concrete situation changes. Yesh Gvul was formed at the time of the Lebanon War, when the Israeli army was operating outside the internationally recognized border. There is a border between Israel and Lebanon over which there is no dispute, and the Israeli army had crossed that border. So that was one set of circumstances. Now, it is claimed by the Israeli government that there is no internationally recognized border between us and the Palestinians. That's true, but the fact is that the 3.5 million Palestinians living without rights under military law, under the domination of the Israeli army, and they've been living like that for 37 years. So there's a different set of circumstances. But in both cases, there's one thing in common, that in our view, the army is being misused. An army that is, in Hebrew, is called Tzva Hagana Israel, the Israel Defense Army, is being used for purposes other than defense. There is no way that Israel was being defended by besieging Beirut in the past, and there is no way that Israel is being defended by devastating and demolishing the refugee houses in the Rafah camp or in the various other actions that the Israeli military is taking in the occupied territories. There is no way that that is in the defense of Israel. That is detrimental, harmful, destructive to Israel. So the circumstances change, but the question should always be asked, as long as we have soldiers, and I pray for the day when there are no soldiers, no armies, no weapons, but as long as these exist, then the very minimum that we can have in the way of insurance is a soldier who asks questions, who has a conscience, who will listen to his convictions at least to the same extent that he listens to the major or the colonel who's giving him it. Orders. And that is the very least that we have to aim for.
What do you see our role as citizens, as world citizens, in both supporting the movement, the refusal movement in Israel, as well as a worldwide refusal movement?
Well, there's a very concrete way of supporting the refusal movement in Israel, and this is a project that we've been running for years now, and that is Adopt a Refusenik. And we appeal to groups in the United States and in other countries to get in contact with us. We have a website, we have email. Get in contact with us, and if you think that what we're doing is important, we'll send out information, and you'll get the name of a refusnik who has just declared his refusal, has been sent to prison, and you can get together and organize in his support. Very practical sense. Write him a letter, send him an email. Call his family, his wife, his children, whoever it is, and say, you know, we have heard of this on the other side of the world. We have heard of your sacrifice, your gesture, your protest, and we sympathize and we admire you. Hang on in there. And that is terribly important. It's very important for us as a refusal movement. We get financial support as well, which is vital because we're not funded by anyone. We're a small opposition group. And these groups get together and they raise a couple of $100, which help us to see the refusnik's family through the period of imprisonment, because there's no income coming in and somebody has to pay the rent or pay for the groceries. So at this very simple, practical level, there's an enormous amount that can be done by people who are interested in, and who consider that our movement is doing useful and valuable work. And of course there's broader support, which I've touched upon, because I think that the issues raised by the refusal movement in Israel are relevant throughout the world, wherever there are soldiers in uniform bearing guns. So that's a broader aspect. But certainly I would stress the practical support that we need and that we're getting from wonderful groups, from synagogues and veterans veterans organizations and church groups and peace groups of all kinds, and just a few people that get together and say, hey, something is happening there and we need to get involved. At least let us in this token way support those people who are actively involved in trying to put an end to the bloodshed. And this is all very, very important. So that is a way of getting involved, of learning about what's happening, learning the individual cases, learning where these people come from. It's one of the fascinating aspects, and this is something that comes across in the book. Again, I'm in the enviable position of being able to praise the book because I didn't write most of it. And the stuff that I didn't write is really fascinating. We have young men who grew up in the extreme far right, who went to school in the religious nationalist schools in the occupied territories, which usually turn out graduates who are pretty fanatical. And these individuals then refuse to serve the occupation because they have that inner moral strength that says, no, this is wrong. And we have communists and Zionists and anti-Zionists and post-Zionists. We have rabbis and we atheists. People come to the refusal issue from many, many different philosophies, from different biographies. There's a significant number of refuseniks who are children of Holocaust survivors. And I think that's also significant. So every individual brings to the issue his entire self, his biography, his family, his convictions, his religion or his anti-religion. And each one has his own peculiar reason for coming to that conclusion. And the wonderful thing is that coming from all these different directions, they come to the same conclusion. And sometimes they come to the same prison and they're physically in the same cell.
Do you have the contact information for your organization?
Yes, certainly. We have a website which is temporarily down. I'm not quite sure whether it was sabotaged by our adversaries or just a technical hitch. But anyway, it's www.yeshgvul. That is YESH-GVUL.org. And we have a email address is very similar. It says info@yeshgvul.org, YESH-GVUL.org. An email there, you get on our email list, and we'll send out information as refuseniks step forward and are sentenced to prison. You can get information about our educational efforts, about the seminars we hold for young people to tell them about these issues, about the vigils we hold outside the prison, about the leafleting, and about lighter stuff. We hold rock concerts. We have many Israeli artists, singers and plastic artists who turn out regularly, and we have rock concerts for young people. It's not quite Woodstock, but we're a small country. And lots of activities of this kind through which we try to put across our message. And I would say with some degree of success. A recent poll showed that of young Israelis, 43% are sympathetic to the idea of refusal. 43%. That's not bad. I think we have one or two percentage points, our contribution to that figure. And in addition to general support and direct contact with Yesh Gvul, I have to point out that there's a very valuable and important support network that has been created here in the United States. It's called the Refuser Solidarity Network, and it's a network here in the United States that organizes support and backing for the refusenik movement in Israel, financial support and political backing, and it organizes tours like mine, and it's helping me to promote this book, and it plays a very important role. So that's the Refuser Solidarity Network, and its website is www.refusersolidarity, that's one word, refusersolidarity.net. And you can get the information there on how they organize support in this country, how they bring refuseniks over to speak to audiences in this country. And they're a vital connecting link between our sympathizers here in the United States and North America generally and the refuser community in Israel.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much.
We've just been talking with Peretz Kidron. He has compiled and edited the book, Refusnik, Israel's Soldiers of Conscience.